My name is Martin Wells. I serve here as one of the directors, and it's my pleasure to be the moderator for tonight's conversation. That's what it will be. We're going to attempt here at Holden, as we have consistently over the years, to do something that the culture can't do very well, and that's talk about hard things in a spirit of grace for one another, a spirit of intensity, because these are important things, of course, to speak of, but a spirit of mutual respect that enlightens us all. And so I ask you all to keep those things in your mind as we pursue our conversation tonight, roughly entitled, The Lessons of Hiroshima and Nagasaki for All Who Care. And we all do. The progression of this evening looks something like this. I'm doing the introduction right now. And then we've asked five persons to give us up to 7 minutes. And I have this really neat watch here that has what we call a countdown timer on it. And so I'm going to set that right now for 7 minutes. And I'm going to ask our speakers to speak. And at 6 minutes, I will stand up and put my hands on their shoulder and gently begin to massage them. And like this. And that will be their sign that they are going to bring their remarks to a conclusion as quickly as possible. And if the beeper goes off, of course, they'd be terribly embarrassed, and so I'm sure they won't let that happen. We have several who are going to share with us tonight. Lyle Severson is a veteran of World War II who served during the period leading up to the dropping of the bombs in August of 1945. His spouse is Ellen Severson, and she was at home with many, many millions of other spouses, both men and women, waiting for the return of their beloved ones. Presumably, there were spouses waiting on all sides of the conflict for the return of their spouses. We've asked Gary Coles, who's in the village, a family physician, and now one who spends considerable time in peace education, to try and begin to form some reflections on the movie some of you may have seen last night, The Day After Trinity, because the whole notion of how science enters the conversation about why we may have done what we did, I think is a very important part of this conversation. The quote, and it should be in quotation marks, "Science has known sin," I can't absolutely verify as having been spoken by Oppenheimer, the head of the Manhattan Project, but I've been led to believe that that is his quotation. Then a little bit on social history from pastoral theologian and teacher at one of our seminaries, Brad Binow, who is going to try and talk something about the difficulty we have bridging the gap between today and then, and the changes that our culture has experienced between that time and today. And then Walter Broman, our theologian and wonderful teaching staff coordinator for this summer, we've asked to reflect again ever so briefly, and he could do several one-hour sessions for you on this topic, on Augsburg 16, the just war tradition, to which all Lutheran people ostensibly devote themselves or acknowledge as our tradition's way of handling the difficulty of how to enter armed conflict and the whole notion of how a war or how a conflict like that is required by our tradition to justify itself before in conscience it can be fought by Christians. So those are the things that we're going to hear from first. Now, we've done forums in a variety of different ways. This is not perfect, to have a whole bunch of people speak to you first. We could form up into small groups, except when I'm around that, I start to itch. I really hate that, so I'm not going to ask you to do that tonight, but that would be another way to pursue the conversation. But I got to be the moderator, so I got to choose the format. So throw stones at me later. I run fast. Then we're going to devote at least a half an hour, oh boy, isn't that short, to some open conversation where all of you will be asked to reflect as best you can on both what has been said by those who are leading us in the dialogue tonight, and by from your own experience, perhaps as a veteran or a spouse or a scientist, a social historian or a theologian or an average person who cares about these issues. Then we're going to also have a very, very brief reflection, because I think the lessons from this day have impact today on current decisions that we may not be thinking of. And so we've asked Brad B. now to very, very briefly hold up one issue that is currently before us as a people that may be influenced by what we can learn from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That's a teaser. What I hope that it does is mean that you'll never pass over an article in Time magazine about that again, because now you will know that something big is at work here that you need to pay attention to. And then I'm going to ask you the hardest question of all. I'm going to ask you what you've learned tonight. And so the only way I can ask you what you've learned tonight is if you listen very carefully. And if you come to this conversation with something of an openness to really hear what others are sharing. And I hope that we all could say we'd learned something tonight, but I'll ask several of you to give us one or two lines about what this conversation has helped you to understand. At that point, the formal conversation for the evening will draw to a close, and yet, for those of you who don't want it to close, who need some better closure for the evening, Bill Eifrig and our chaplain, Jeff Merkel, our pastor Jeff Merkel, have a musical piece that they believe are going to introduce separately. They believe it will contribute to the end and the digestion of all that we say. That will lead into the service of Compline, to which all of you are invited to stay. So that's the outline for the evening. Is there anybody who has any questions about where we're headed? This plane is going to Los Angeles. If you've gotten on the wrong plane, please deplane now. Okay? Thank you very much. Let's begin with Lyle.
Has the clock started?
The clock has started.
Okay. Ellen and I have been married for 54 years. We've gone together for 59. And we just had quite an interesting experience. During World War II, I wrote letters almost every day, and she did likewise. They got put in a box after the war, and 50 years later, we took them out of the box, not having looked at them in all that time, and just reread them. I need to talk about that 3.5 year period, in fact, even a little more, because you can't talk about Hiroshima, you can't talk about Nagasaki without putting it in context. And the context, as far as I'm concerned, is pre-Pearl Harbor. When I was at St. Olaf College, the war clouds were gathering, and we were not interested. And I think we represented, by we, the students, we represented most of the public. And if you read history, you know that now, because Roosevelt would have already had us in the war. The things that he did, if they were known, he would have been impeached for, because he wanted us in the war. We marched, and then after Norway was attacked, my goodness, President St. Olaf was ready to send us all to war. And we still were not involved. We still felt this was not our problem. I marched. We went on a strike at St. Olaf. I marched with a peace placard. That's their problem. Well, Ellen and I got married after I graduated. I started teaching school, and on December 7th, all that changed. We got an answer to "you're not involved." We said, that answer was, yes, you are involved. My country was threatened. It was attacked. My God and my church was attacked, as far as I was concerned. And certainly my family was in danger. Ellen was pregnant. Nonetheless, at the end of that school year, I was drafted. I wanted to be drafted. I wanted to be in the service. It was As far as I was concerned, a just war. I knew what had happened on December 7th. And so shortly I was in the service, and a few months later I got a chance to come home and see our son, my first son. I was home for about 3 days. I learned that you got to change that diaper on a boy quick or you get peed on. I learned the lesson quickly, but I was only home for 3 days and I didn't see that boy again until he was over three. Well, I shortly found myself in the Pacific, and you're not interested in my career as a serviceman, but I tell you a part of it because it's applicable to my perception. I was put in plans and operation of what was called Jack's Pack in Hawaii. Jack's Pack was a joint airways communication system of the Pacific. It covered both theaters, MacArthur's and Nimitz. It had worked with the Marines, with the Army Air Corps, and with the Navy Air Corps. There was such a shortage of personnel, such a shortage of equipment, that no invasion was going to take place without joint looking at it from the part of all three services and determining who was going to go, who was going to do what. And from then on, I was working with Code Words. We were putting together cadres of communication, personnel, and equipment, control towers, radio ranges, homing beacons, direction finding, all of this. And for each invasion, we worked with a code word. Maybe 6 weeks, 8 weeks later, we would find out where it went. And of course, then it was Tarawa, it was Kwajalein, it was Guam, Saipan, from MacArthur's area, it was Guadalcanal up through New Guinea, Aniwetok, Palau, and into the Philippines. And each of those invasions, the casualties mounted, the first one in which I really felt the impact was from the invasion of Tarawa. All those casualties came back to Hawaii. Every person in the hospital that could walk was moved out of a hospital to make room for the casualties of that first little invasion of that island. We learned quickly that these little Japs, who we call them, were fighters, and they were vicious fighters. And they had taken, practically overnight, the whole Pacific area after Pearl Harbor. Well, the point, all of these casualties were taking place, and then all this time, I'm writing letters, getting letters from Ellen, but then came, finally, VE Day, and we were no longer a forgotten war, because we had such a shortage of personnel, such a shortage of equipment, because the real war was going on in Europe. And then, of course, we were happy when Normandy was invaded. But it was another year before the war was over in Europe. The most vicious fighting took place after Normandy. And then with VE Day, I just reread my letter. I wrote to Ellen, I said, there was no celebrating out here. There were no bands playing. There's a job yet to be done. And I wish I could be home in a month or so, but I won't be. And I got the signal, but I'm okay in 1 minute. Anyway, I warned her in the letter and subsequent letters. An invasion of Japan will be necessary. It will be the most tremendous fight that you ever saw. They believe in the emperor, and their emperor is God, and they will fight as viciously as the Germans ever did. Unless some miracle takes place. And as far as I'm concerned, it did with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. As far as I'm concerned, it saved millions of lives, not thousands. It saved millions of lives in U.S. casualty. I will never forget flying over Leyte Gulf on about August 1st and seeing, I got down in the bomb site, in the bomb section, in the nose of that B-25, we flew over Leyte, and it was just a bang, bang, bang. Mile after mile after mile of ships that were all ready to invade Japan. And I found out that later, we were, from the code words we were working on, those ships were going to go into Formosa, now Taiwan, and Kyushu? And what percentage of those men would have been lost? What percentage of the Japanese population would have been lost if we had had to make those landings and then go all the way up from Kyushu to Kobe, to Tokyo, and on up into the island of Hokkaido? So that's it. But that's the way I see Hiroshima, and that's the way I see Nagasaki. And it got the war over and got us home. And if it hadn't, we wouldn't even be here in Holden Village having this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Bill.
Lyle.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
I'm Bill.
Ellen. Please share.
The views of a waiting wife or spouse at the end of the war against Japan. I wonder if the fact that no other woman or spouse volunteered to do this means that I'm the oldest woman here in Golden Village. Most of us, of course, were at home tending our babies and doing the usual things. Elfrida, though, was one of those who joined the service, and she was a single woman, and there were a lot of women who did join the service, or they went out and worked in defense plants. However, I was a waiting wife with a baby, and for 3.5 years we waited. At that time, I don't think, well, and as I look back now, I don't think anyone can imagine the unity that was felt among the people at home. It was just amazing to see how immediately after December 7th, people rallied and volunteered and did all the things they had to do to make this a success. The American people just gathered together. And I look back and remember how willingly and proudly we gave up our sons and our husbands for a cause that we respected. Compared to the Vietnam War, we really believed that this was the right thing to do. And of course, many of us had different feelings about the Vietnam War. There was the unity, and then there was also the sacrifices that people made. Like, it's funny to talk about this because this is so familiar to us, but when we talk with our children who were born way after the war, they just don't understand the rationing that went on and how tires were scarce and how this was before plastic, and so there were no rubber pants for our babies, and we all had to adjust to all of these things. It was certainly a change in our lifestyles. And there were complications in that the allotments that were given the spouses of the servicemen, of course, didn't pay for food, clothing, and shelter. And so many of the wives would settle into a little apartment. They'd take their babies, and there would be two or three wives to one apartment. I had complications after, in fact, both baby and I had complications after the birth. So my mother and dad took me in and were perfectly willing to sacrifice the space. And to them it wasn't a sacrifice because it was adding a grandchild into a family. And so we got along fine. It was just accepted that this is the sort of thing that would go on. And we didn't seem to mind because we had a little bit of an idea of what our guys were doing and in the fields and certainly it wasn't hurting us to make these sacrifices. The most important part of the day was writing letters. But we didn't write just to our husbands or our boyfriends. We wrote to our cousins that were scattered throughout the war zones, and friends, even friends that we didn't know very well. But we knew that they appreciated getting mail. And so we did do a lot of letter writing. That letter writing was also a way of forgetting about ourselves, too, and showing our love and concern for others. At church, I remember on Sunday mornings, there would be mention of the names of victims who had died or were missing in action. And everyone rallied around the parents or the family of the people that this had happened to. And there was a lot of concern that was shown that we probably wouldn't show as much interest in the people at all if we hadn't got word of what they were going through. Most of all, I think, what really showed up was the unity of the wives and all Americans. They believed that this was something that had to be done. And everyone knew we were going to have to wait, and we accepted. And I think about today, if we had such long separations between people, between couples, in fact, I was thinking, not once did I think that Lyle might be unfaithful to me when we were separated for those 3 years. Didn't even occur to me. And now, today, people can go on trips and, decide, well, that's reason for separation and even divorce. So, actually, I guess some good things maybe came out of it too, even though it isn't what we wanted, and certainly as Christian people, it wasn't what we wanted, but it was something that had to be done.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Gary?
I'm Gary Coles. My credentials include the fact that I'm a member of Veterans for Peace, an organization of veterans who've experienced war and the horrors of war and come back from those wars, just wanting to tell the truth about them and do whatever can be done to stop future wars, etc. To tell the truth, basically, to people who are open-minded makes people realize it can't happen again. I am also a physician that works at a state mental institution for the chemically dependent and mentally ill. I have extensive experience with post-traumatic stress disorder, and the worst cases are those veterans who have been in combat, have seen the horror, the gruesome, the mutilated bodies, the rapes. They are oftentimes perpetrators in the massive evil that occurs in combat. And they are also victims. They have seen their buddies die horrible deaths and suffer, and they know they can't do anything about it. They are affected by severe guilt, and they come back morally and spiritually destroyed, many of them, unable to believe in a loving God or any other God for the rest of their lives. They are tormented by repeated intrusive memory and nightmares, and it's a horrible existence. And the truth of the matter is that more people from Vietnam that were in Vietnam have killed themselves since returning from Vietnam than actually died in the war. Some estimates are that twice as many Vietnam veterans have committed suicide since Vietnam than actually died in the war. That was 58,000 that died in the war. And the ones that haven't died are in agony. I have been involved in group sessions with veterans, not just from Vietnam, but from Korea and World War II, because it happens in every war. When people see hell and Satan and the satanic things that happen in hand-to-hand combat, and suffering and death, they can't forget it. It's an intrusive memory that remains with them the rest of their lives, and we should have somebody like that on this panel. We should also have a legitimate war historian on this panel, because the evidence is overwhelming that neither bomb was necessary. Japan was ready to surrender. They were looking for a couple of months on ways of surrender. The Russian ambassador, the Japanese ambassador to Moscow, was looking for ways to communicate with Washington on terms of surrender. Washington insisted on unconditional surrender. Japanese were willing to surrender, only allowing Hirohito to remain a figurehead emperor. We would not allow that. The truth is that Russia was going to declare war on Japan on May 8th. They decided to declare war on Japan in 90 days, if it wasn't over with. That was August 8th, 2 days after Hiroshima. And we did not want Russia to share in the spoils or have anything to do with the war reparations, et cetera. And so it's very valid argument that we use one or both of those bombs as a demonstration to Russia to back off. We won the war, and it worked. We knew that Japan was on its knees. We had a successful sea blockade. They were defeated already. Eisenhower said it. There were many officials in the United States government, even the military people, who knew that Japan was ready to surrender without even an invasion. So, but we had this propaganda. I believed it for 40 years, that the propaganda worked on me, that we said, well, we had to do it or the war wouldn't have ended. If anybody wants more information, there's a great article in the Sojourners magazine, in the Resource Center, the latest Sojourners magazine, from a very good historian, Gar Elkerwitz. I suggest everybody read it. I suggest everybody read the current literature. There is yet more truth to be understood about that war. Much of it was suppressed. Much of what we understand about that war was actually propaganda. All the photographic evidence, as much of the photographic evidence of after the war as possible, was confiscated by the government and suppressed from general circulation. We did not see as much of the victimization and the suffering as we should have to understand the carnage. I have letters and information from military people that went into Hiroshima and Nagasaki afterward, and they said, I am ashamed to be an American. We need someone on this panel who was a victim.
Let's not talk about who should be here. Let's talk about the topic I asked you to speak about.
Scientists in military situations. What happened in that situation, and those of us who saw the day after Trinity last night, realized how intense the scientific process was in developing the war, the bomb, both bombs. They were good, decent people. The people who fought in that war were good, decent people. I'm not blaming any military people. I'm not blaming any scientists. We would all be in the same situation. We had our jobs. We were in a massive bureaucracy. They had a project to complete. And they believed, by the way, that the bomb was going to be used against Hitler, against Germany. That was the understanding of all the scientists. If they knew, but the War Department knew for at least a year and maybe two that the bomb was going to be used against Japan, which was not a nuclear threat. Nobody thought that Japan was going to build a bomb. Nazi Germany was suspected of having the capability to build a bomb. So anyway, they were involved in a massive bureaucracy, and that's the evil of massive bureaucracies, is that nobody claims responsibility for that bomb. But there were thousands of people in various stages. The people who flew the Enola Gay were just a part of the process. They were the last trigger. They were as innocent as the person who fashioned the trigger or people in Hanford that were making the plutonium. That's what happens when science does not do the moral deliberation. They were sucked in. And when those scientists in Los Alamos realized that this was against Japan, many of them felt very deceived. Many of them were threatening to quit. And Oppenheimer himself said, if we'd have known, we would have stopped the project the day after Trinity, the title of the film. So science, military, We put our efforts in. We think we're decent human beings, and we think we're doing the right thing, but we're only taking orders from above. We do not claim responsibility. That's the lesson we learned at Nuremberg. The psychologist who fashioned the death to mental inmates. You know, there was a massive extermination of people who were mentally ill or physically deformed in Nazi Germany. Each scientist said, it was not my responsibility. I am not responsible. I am not responsible. That chant went on and on and on. And nobody felt responsible because they were all in a massive bureaucratic structure. War machines are massive bureaucratic structures. Los Alamos was a massive bureaucratic structure. Nobody was responsible for the atrocity that was war. The main issue for those of us who are Christians are, what would Jesus do? What is the church's role in preventing this from happening again? Do we have the courage to teach what Jesus taught on this subject? That's the issue. And the church is basically silent. It goes along with what the state wants. It's a serious moral and serious theological issue that we are not doing a very good job at deliberating on.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you. Brad.
I'm Brad Benow. I teach pastoral theology at Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus, Ohio. Prior to that, 6 years in parish ministry in Southern California. I don't really know what I'm doing on this panel. I'm going to turn 40 at the end of the month. So I didn't even come along until 10 years after Hiroshima. Haven't been a veteran. I'm a real junior theologian compared to Walt. I'm not a physician. Insights into helping people who suffer through war. I don't want to be, you know, dismissive of what I might contribute, but I just want to put myself in the right context here. In my undergraduate studies at Capital University, I was a history major. Tried to specialize in 20th century American history. A lot of what I know about this period comes through that kind of study. I've always been especially interested in the biographies that inform history. I think that's probably why I ended up being a pastoral theologian rather than a church historian. I've come in the last few years to develop an interest in the topic of cynicism, partly because when I teach first-year seminarians and ask them to take a look at what their own issues are that they bring to ministry that may be troublesome, this topic keeps coming up. Either I note their cynicism for them, or they note for me that they have trouble getting past their cynicism. As I began to put that on some sort of historical grid, it seems to me that the period of time in the late 30s and through the 40s was a much less cynical time than where we came in the 60s and the 70s. Now, defining cynicism as a kind of predisposition to disbelieve in the goodness or sincerity of anything that human beings do. Cynicism is not just skepticism, kind of healthy suspicion about, you know, things. The cynic, as a pastor colleague I know has described them, the modern cynic is a jeerleader. Sort of like that term. The modern cynic is not content just to be skeptical, but really has a sort of crusade to jeer at anybody who takes anything of sincerity seriously. Tried to read some in Douglas John Hall, who many of you know is a pretty solid theologian. I like the way he frames it, that the opposite ends of what I think really are the same spectrum end up being cynicism at the one end, as I just described it, and what he calls credulity at the other end. Let me just quick quote from him about how he defines that. He says, credulity means an inordinate readiness to believe. In the state of credulity, one convinces oneself in advance that the world really works according to the beautiful ideas one cherishes. There are, therefore, a great many things that credulous persons just don't see because they put blinders on curiosity and squelch altogether the human tendency to doubt. It says more, but that's, you know, that's enough. I guess it strikes me in terms of social history that in the last 50 years we've moved through cycles of credulity and cynicism. I mean, I really respect everything that's being shared from 50 years ago by our two panelists, which, you know, my parents lived through that time, and I sort of resonate with that. And I think this was a much less cynical era, and that's one thing that characterized it. If you've ever seen the movie The Best Years of Our Lives, Academy Award winner in 1947, I think, about people coming home from World War II, you just know that this was not a cynical time. I think the question is, was it a time of credulity when people were ready to believe what they wanted to believe? And, you know, I don't have a firm answer for that. I think there's some evidence in some cases that was the case. There were others who responsibly asked the hard questions and so forth. I speak a little better about where things have unfolded since then. I think there's no question that what happened on the 22nd of November 1963 for my generation set off a cycle of cynicism that echoed through two more assassinations, a Vietnam War, a Watergate, an Iran-Contra scandal, a number of government officers going to prison for various things. I have a real vivid memory of when being on internship in seminary in 1979-80, I served near Washington, D.C. Conversation at some kind of social gathering with my internship pastor, where it just became very clear to me all of a sudden that he was formed in a time around World War II, shortly thereafter, that was not a cynical era. And I could not think about government, politics, American life in the same way, badly as I might want to. I had to get past the cynicism that my growing up years contributed to. Well, let me say this just in conclusion. I think what Christians are called to do is move past the cynicism, credulity matrix, and really represent the Christian virtue of hope, which is finally the antidote for both credulity and cynicism. Hope, Eric Erickson, a psychologist, says that hope is the ability to believe in the attainability of one's fervent wishes despite the dark rages that well up inside of us. And we are called as Christians somehow authentically to work toward the fervent attainability of those things that represent God's reign, despite all that we've heard about, science knowing sin, the darkness of all of that, to stay free from both cynicism and credulity. It's not easy, but the answer is not in moving back and forth between credulity and cynicism, but to get out of that and go someplace that I think the reign of God would have us go.
Thank you.
Walter.
Along with most mainline Christians, Lutherans subscribe to the concept of just war or justifiable violence. Article 16 of the Augsburg Confession, it could be echoed in Catholic moral theology, in Episcopal, Presbyterian, Methodist, and other traditions documents. Our churches teach that lawful civil ordinances are good works of God, and that it is right for Christians to hold civil office, to sit as judges, to decide matters by the imperial and other existing laws, to award just punishments, to engage in just wars, to serve as soldiers, to make legal contracts, to hold property, to swear oaths when required by magistrates, to marry, and to be given in marriage, to engage in just wars. For 1,000 years, the just war doctrine was more or less taught and more or less accepted by most Christians, and often even practiced. It was divided into two elements: the conduct before the beginning of a war and the conduct in war. One can summarize its main provisions quite simply. The conduct before a war begins must be that all peaceful means to resolve the conflict have been exhausted. B, that one is the victim of an aggressive attack. And C, that one, that the war be declared by legitimate authority. Just to cite some examples, I think one could say that the Civil War in the United States was one of the wars that we fought according to the principles of just war doctrine. At least a little bit about Sherman's march to the sea near the end of the war, but basically the war was declared by legitimate authority. The means for resolving the conflict were exhausted, and the attack on Fort Sumter was the occasion, the provocation for the war. And in the main, it was conducted according to the just war concepts. In the conflict itself, just war concept involved three things. First of all, that one have limited goals. The limited goal of the war must be to restore the status quo ante bellum, that is, to restore the situation before the war begins. The second is that the war must be fought with humane means, whatever that means. In other words, we ought not use, among other things, weapons of mass destruction. But at the time that the just war doctrine was formulated, combat was largely between individuals on a battlefield. And they were armed and armored relatively equally. And that's what was understood by humane means. The third element of just war doctrine is that war not be made on civilian populations. Largely characteristic of the American Civil War. One of the problems of the just war doctrine is that we have not appropriately schooled ourselves in it. John Howard Yoder, who often came here to Holden, always raised the question of Lutherans and other mainline Christian traditions, did we know the provisions of what justifiable war were? Were we schooled in that? Did we have any concept of how we might challenge or raise issues about the kinds of wars in which we were engaged? It would be interesting, you see, to ask how many of the wars in which the United States have engaged were in fact justifiable wars. I grew up, I was 17, going on 17, when the Second World War ended. I resonate to absolutely everything both of you said, because that was very, very formative for my own bringing up. But I had never heard of the just war doctrine. I had never been schooled in it. I had no way of asking any of the questions. I've spent a good part of my leisure time since my experiences in Germany reading about this century and its wars, partly because a very fateful thing happened. In the First World War, we lost the capacity, I think, to engage in just war. The First World War was a dreadful scar already on the 20th century, awaiting an even more dreadful one in the rise of Nazism. But I've been reading here at Holden the last couple of weeks a book by William Manchester called The Arms of Krupp. It's a book about Germany's largest supplier of weapons, and it has told me a lot of shocking things. One of the things it told me is that Krupp supplied weapons to 31 of the 57 countries that fought in World War I. Unexploded bombs that landed among the Germans from the British were manufactured by Vickers, the British arms manufacturing company, or were manufactured by Krupp, but that Vickers held patents owned by Krupp. And after the war, Vickers paid Krupp £40,000 for the bombs that it dropped on German soldiers, to say nothing, of course, of what Krupp was doing to other countries. One comment here is that both the British and the Germans were almost casual about the loss of life in the Second World War, and called it normal wastage. And it is quite clear now that the Germans indeed had plans to wage war on civilians in Belgium and France and elsewhere. The problem, as Hans-Werner Bartsch indicates with the just war doctrine, is that it is no longer possible for us to be conscientious objectors. Because in an era of total war, one is either assisting one side or the other, and conscientious objectors are people who are assisting the other side by their objection. The challenge for us, therefore, is to ask, I think, two questions. One is, are the just war criteria applicable? And the second one is, if they are not, what are the kinds of things that we must do as Christians to prevent the kind of conflicts that we have seen in this century? The irony of the Second World War, just to bring this all full circle, is that about half of it qualifies under just war criteria, the war against Germany. But the occasion for the unity of the United States was the attack on us by Japan. And yet that was, in a sense, the least justifiable. The best book on Japanese-American diplomatic relations, that some of which you were alluding to, is by John Toland. It's a two-volume work called The Rising Sun, and it's almost must reading for anybody who wants to think about America in the 20th century and our role in the Pacific leading up to Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Thank you all. Thank you all for observing the time limitations so that we can get to a more open conversation now. I'm interested in how you would like to speak questions to our panelists. In a perfect world, not too many questions would be directed to them, because then they'll start to speak again and they've already had 7 minutes. So, I mean, this is frightfully short and only the beginning of a conversation. What are your comments? Yes.
I, regardless of what you just said, Martin, I'd like to address a question to Walt. We are a Christian gathering, and regardless of our Lutheran tradition, and regardless of the Augsburg Confession and other documents and so on, the history of the Christian Church goes back before Constantine, the first 300 years. Christians were total pacifists. And when Constantine came along, Christianity and Constantine accommodated each other. And there were some compromises made, and the just war tradition was created. Should we not go back to the original Christian teachings, the teachings of Christ that took place and were practiced during the first 300 years of Christianity?
No.
Thank you.
I really owe you an elaboration of that. Constantine is a handy sort of benchmark, but in point of fact, it was probably several hundred years after Constantine before the just war notion was developed. Before Constantine, Christians were a minority, very much a minority, had little responsibility for what was going on. The Roman army was largely the Roman police. The Roman Empire was a relatively, for that age, and probably by comparison with a lot of other ages, a relatively humane operation. And military service meant largely police service, and the Roman army meant largely defending the frontiers. So Christians could stand aloof from all of that, and bear witness in a way that probably has not been possible since. The problem, I think, can be illustrated by the differences between Helmut von Moltke and Dietrich Bonhoeffer in Germany during the Nazi years. They knew each other, and they knew each other well, and they knew what each stood for. Bonhoeffer was a personal pacifist, but when he returned to Germany in 1939, he became deeply involved in the plots to assassinate Hitler, knowing, first of all, that the assassination itself would be an act of violence, that it would not spare other people in Hitler's immediate vicinity, and that it would provoke civil war within Germany between the forces that were supporting the conspirators and the forces that would certainly resist any capitulation to the Allies. So Bonhoeffer was committed to violence on the principle that what Hitler was up to was worse. So one is choosing between the lesser of evils. Von Moltke, on the other hand, refused to participate in any plots at all. He refused to do any violence. He regarded Hitler as a judgment of God upon Germany and a judgment to be endured. The question was, endured by whom? It was endured by 20 million citizens of the Soviet Union. It was endured by the 6 million Jews who lost their lives. It was endured by all the people who were in concentration camps, by all the victims of bombings and so on and so on. So von Moltke's position to endure God's judgment was to be paid for by the 50 million casualties in the European theater of the Second World War. Who of them was right? Von Moltke was executed for defeatism on the 25th of January 1945, and Bonhoeffer was executed for treason on the 9th of April. That represents, I think, the kind of dilemma. Both deeply powerful Christian people, both writing marvelous testimonies to their faith in the gospel, both martyrs, and both choosing totally opposite courses. How can one say, yes, let's go back before Constantine? The questions are incredibly ambiguous and morally devastating.
Thank you. Question over here.
I would just like to remind, however, that Dietrich Bonhoeffer fully accepted the sinfulness of his act, exactly, and was fully prepared to pay the price for that act. And which of us, as patriotic draftees, are willing to pay that price? I would say not very many.
Thank you. Mark?
I just wanted to comment on sort of the issue of sort of a unified front from the reading that I've done. There was a peace movement during World War II. There were conscientious objectors, a fair number of them, and that those folks spent the war years in work camps, as I understand it, sort of doing alternative service. So, you know, for me, there is, as an activist, as a peace activist, I draw on that even in this time when there was this sense of kind of the ultimate evil, that Christian people still stood up and said, you can't fight evil with evil necessarily, that there is an alternative way to do that. And I think that becomes part of our dilemma and our challenge is, when confronted with evil, how do you do it? Do you pick up the rock, the gun, or you take a Gandhian approach of standing in front of the gun, defenseless?
Thank you. Paul?
It seems to me you could make a case, and I guess I myself would be willing to make the case, that the just war theory still makes some sense. Particularly those last two criteria that you raised, Walt, the proportion and discrimination. That discrimination, the violence should not involve civilians, and proportion, the damage that the war does should not exceed the damage that you're trying to correct by the war. And by both of those standards, almost any kind of modern warfare is simply ungodly. Guernica, you know the wonderful painting of Pablo Picasso after the Spanish loyalists bombed this little town in Spain. That's the first time aerial bombing was part of warfare. And Picasso painted this huge wall. It's just a shocking painting. And that was his cry of anguish in the face of that. And I think any bombing, any kind of bombing, is ungodly. Okay.
Thank you. Yes. No? Thought you had your hand up.
Yes, actually.
Okay.
I would like to hear either members of the panel or just other people here comment on how we should be applying some of the lessons we've learned from past wars to the current situation in Bosnia. That's what makes this discussion feel very current for me, that these are not just rehashing previous dilemmas, but how do we apply these questions to the current situation and making a decision of what American involvement should be in Bosnia?
I'll take that one.
Great.
Great question. The trouble is that we only do our moral deliberation when it's already too late, and everybody's masked on either side. They're already doing the killing. It's too late, folks. You know, and are we Christian agnostics? We don't trust Jesus. We don't teach what Jesus taught. That's what I'm hearing here. We're Christian agnostics, as we don't know what to believe. You know, we don't trust Jesus. What Christian nonviolence is all about, in its most effective form, is as a preventive. If the Bosnian, if the Yugoslavian churches had taught what Jesus taught for the last 1700 years, there would not be a war in Yugoslavia. The Croatian Catholic Church and the Serbian Orthodox Church are both at each other's throat, and the bishops and ministers are saying, kill, 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 God is on our side. Same way with Rwanda. Tremendous missionary effort went into there for a century. Christian missionaries were over there teaching Christianity. They got 90% of the population of Rwanda to be Christian. They didn't teach Christian nonviolence, and look what happened. It's a preventive thing, and the church is at fault for not teaching what Jesus taught. We don't dare to do it. We're going to offend our government if we do that. In the United States Constitution, it's the only crime they talk about, and the punishment is treason. Giving aid and comfort to the enemy is punishable by death. The United States Constitution, that's anti-gospel. That's not what Jesus said. Jesus said, love your enemies. Paul said, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him drink. We're in this mess because we're not doing what Jesus said. And there is no war known to me, or even any revolution, that can be considered just because civilians are not protected. That's an inviolable point of the just war theory, that civilians are to be protected. And, you know, Nagasaki and Hiroshima were largely civilian targets. Therefore, that was not justified. So World War II is not a just war. And we have to be preventing that next one. We have to start now. We may not ever see the seeds of our progress, but we need to start now to prevent that next Rwanda, the next Yugoslavia. The Christian church has to meet an ecumenical council and say, let's start teaching what Jesus taught. You know, stop talking about, you know, pacifists in the middle of a raging war. It's too late, folks. We got to do it as a prevention.